coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody and welcome this Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well. Hope everybody is hunkered down and warm. God bless all the people out there in Tennessee right now going through the flooding. Although, like I texted some friends today, this right behind me are my decanters. Buffalo Trace lives in there regularly. Not a bad idea to go out and buy some Buffalo Trace stock right now, folks. You know, at least as far as a few bottles of whiskey before the prices go up on the shelves, because the Buffalo Trace Distillery was part of the major flooding, and they lost a huge section of property in the back. So things will go into low production. Little tip for you there from Curious Realm, everyone. We have an exciting show tonight. I am very, very excited. Our second guest after the break will be our good friend Ann Celine. For those of you not familiar with the format, we normally have a live guest in the first segment. That way we can go long if conversation dictates that, and we don't have a guest waiting in the wings. But our second guest, even though they are pre-recorded, is always new material. We have never, either as our previous incarnation or as Curious Realm, done a repeat show or a greatest hits or re-recorded stuff. So yeah, it's always new. We'll be talking with Ann Celine tonight, specifically about the psychology of the paranormal, and not only the psychology of belief and the way that our brains look for patterns in life and look for confirmations of patterns, but how these things, and specifically how traumas, because so many times a paranormal experience is somewhat traumatic for somebody. It's a shaking of worlds, you know, one of those things that will really change the paradigms with which you see reality. And when that happens, things change in the brain. You know, we begin looking at things in a different way. So how does that affect us? And with that in mind, before we introduce our second guest, we had somebody on social media, a group of people on social media today, come out against an event that we have that we are coming up with. And I'm not going to mention the event in conjunction with this attitude, but our first topic tonight is remote viewing. And, you know, when it comes to psychic abilities, when it comes to these literal natural abilities, it's not like anybody has to go into a trance or trance-like state for remote viewing to happen. However, there were a lot of comments regarding sorcery and dark magic and things like that. And I'm here to tell you, folks, as a former Catholic seminarian, as somebody who spent a good clip of my life studying theologies of the world, this is one of those things that, as a commenter mentioned, like, this seems like a natural talent that if you're not using it would be more of a sin, you know, which is an interesting concept. And the idea of a natural talent is what I want to springboard off of, when it comes to remote viewing, because though you can take remote viewing training, things like that, it's not like meditation or finding a guru and trying to attain enlightenment. It's almost the opposite of that, and it's really interesting. So our guest in the first segment tonight is our good friend, Greg Redabaugh. We have had him on the show. We had him on the show on the IRVA cruise this last year. He is one of the new IRVA board of directors, IRVA being the International Remote Viewing Association. I am a lifetime member. I am now, I wouldn't say an adept practitioner, Greg, but at least a practitioner of remote viewing. And it is definitely something that over the last 20-something years of my life, I've heard it. I've heard it in communities. I've done research on it, things like that. But until I actively experienced it, I don't think my mind was as attuned to it as it is now. you know. So welcome back to the show, Greg. How have you been doing?
Thank you. Great to be back again, Chris.
Absolutely, man. Our conversation on the Mariner of the Seas during the Irva cruise this last year was very enlightening. And you have a very, very amazing and honorable career of working in the world of intelligentsia, Department of Defense, all kinds of things. How did you first come to the world of remote viewing, Greg? How did that was remote viewing there before you were involved in that world, or did the world of intelligentsia lead you down the path of remote viewing? How did that come about for you?
Well, I've always had a talent for experiencing things that would be considered paranormal. It was easy for me to be comfortable with it because my mother was extremely psychic, and which meant I couldn't get away with anything. So, I mean, it just seemed natural to me, and it's something I've always had an interest in. I had a brush with the remote viewing community when it was still part of the military and kept under wraps.
Okay.
Because I worked with Dale Graff at DIA for a time. When it first came out back in, well, let me back up a bit.
Sure.
When this concept of remote viewing first came about, I mean, psychic ability has been studied for years. Dr. Dean Radin has several books citing 130 years of studies proving that this capability exists. And it's not a question of does it exist. The question now is how do you apply it? And how do you increase your abilities, increase your accuracy? And that's where you'll get several different versions of controlled remote viewing.
Yeah.
But it kind of started out in 1921 with René Warkau here in his book, Mind to Mind. And that's why the IRBA has a yearly prize for those doing research in remote viewing called the Warkau-Year Prize. And it really kind of started from a government time back in 1971, when the American Society for Psychic Research started doing some studies on clairvoyance, clairaudio, and they decided to call it remote viewing because when you're doing remote viewing, you're actually combining several of those concepts that have separate definitions about them in standard parapsychology terms. So when you're doing a remote viewing session, you could be doing clairvoyance, you could be doing clairaudience, you could be smelling things, touching things, and so on. So bringing all that together in one concept, they decided to call it remote viewing. And back in 1972, Hal Puthoff was at Stanford Research Institute, and he was introduced to Ingo Swann. And together they were studying how do you put this into practice. And so along the way, Hal mentioned this to a friend of his at CIA who said, that's interesting because we've been having studies done looking at what is going on in the Soviet bloc. Because we knew through intelligence that the Eastern Bloc and Russia were particularly interested in psychic ability and how to apply it. And so the thought was, if they think there's something to this, we probably ought to take at least a look at it to see if there's something to it from our perspective, because that could be a potential threat. And so it's from that point that CIA started funding some research at SRI with Al and Ingo and others at the beginning, like Pat Price and Hella Hammett, and Russell Targ came in a little bit later. And that's when they started developing the concept of controlled remote viewing. And a lot of that has to do with the way Ingo Swann approached it and being able to set up protocols that, in essence, discipline your mind in thinking and receiving this data without it being contaminated by your imagination, by outside factors, and so on. And so the key is to practice it, as others like Joe McMonagle and Lynn Buchanan have said, it's kind of like a martial art for the mind.
Yeah.
In requiring that discipline. And so the controlled remote viewing protocol provides that discipline for you to be able to focus on the data that you're supposed to be getting. And so that's when they decided in 1977 to set up an actual remote viewing unit under the auspices of the U.S. Army. And it originally started off as Gondola Wish, and they had several cover name changes, Grill Flame, and so on, and finally ended up with Stargate, which is what everybody knows. And eventually, by 1995, it had made its way back to CIA as a sponsor, and then CIA shut it down.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and that's when, just before that, we started seeing some inklings of the program and remote viewing as practice coming out in books like Joe McMonagle's Mind Trek back in, I think it was 1996. And then a year later, Dave Morehouse wrote his book called Psychic Warrior. Mm. But the one that really made the breakthrough that caused everybody to kind of sit up and go, oh, is the book Remote Viewing by Tim Schnabel, which kind of pulled together the history. And that kind of opened the floodgates and started the declassification of some of this that's going on. And that's where you started having new teachers coming out. Originally, the members of the military unit, such as Paul Smith, Bill Ray, Tom McNear, Mel Riley, Joe McMonagle, Lynn Buchanan, and Dave Morehouse, and others, started educating people on this concept of controlled remote viewing. And why was the military interested in it? Because it was, in essence, a way of gathering intelligence by means that you didn't have any other way to get it.
Yeah.
And so if you're, you know, looking at remote viewing and wondering, you know, what is it? What do, when I, you go out on the internet and you see things like CRV, you know, controlled remote viewing, you'll things like ERV, extended remote viewing, which is more of a natural way of getting in the data without the strict protocols. Then you've got associative remote viewing, which I'll talk about later. And then you have other people that have started teaching it. And in some cases, it's a business sense of, I need to have something to trademark. That I can, you know, make sure that my material is protected. So you have things like technical remote viewing, which was put together by a major at Dames, who was part of the unit.
Yeah.
Scientific remote viewing, which was done by Courtney Brown at the Farsight Institute. Then you have transdimensional systems remote viewing that was put together by Prudence Calabrese. And then there was a group in Hawaii led by Glenn Wheaton that was the Hawaii Remote Viewing Guild. And they had more of a freestyle. Sometimes you might have seen either Courtney Brown or the Hawaii group use a whiteboard. And they'll just kind of free flow the data and put it down on the board for collecting it. But all of these capabilities are kind of come together under the sponsorship of the International Remote Viewing Association. So it was recognized back in 1999 that there needed to be an organization that would help help, in essence, pull together all the disparate capabilities out there, all the disparate teachers and methods, and provide them a place that's, in essence, a clearinghouse and a place that will try to set standards for, you know, what is remote viewing, and so on. In fact, IRVIC has recently started a professional part of IRVA that has standards for people that want to apply to become certified to be professional remote viewers, so that, you know, people make a living at this.
Yeah.
And it's a way of being able to provide credentials to potential clients out there that I've been through it. I've done the training, I've done the practice, I've done the operational targets.
Yeah.
And here's basically my bona fides. So, you know, it's worth your money to hire me.
Well, and you know, that's where for me it gets fascinating and really interesting, Greg, is what, because of course the government has sponsored numerous programs, sponsors numerous tech programs, all kinds of, I mean, people forget the fact that Facebook got its initial round of funding from InQtel. You know, they're basically the financial arm of the CIA that reaches out to future looking technologies, things like that. And, you know, there are entire branches of the government that are dedicated to things like this, DARPA, all kinds of stuff. And what's always fascinated me is the fact of once a program goes on and shows its efficacy, it's frequently dissolved for the fact of now it will be in the hands of contractors. So that it's not a defined part of the governmental protocol or a defined part of anything that can be used intelligentsia wise against the government, you know, but contractors thereof are still definitely using it, you know, whether or not the Army itself is using it, contractors of the Army are using it, contractors of other contractors, and even the applications that are out there. I remember meeting people at Menlo Park and things like that that were doing like city planning, that kind of stuff. There's a company that is actively employing remote viewing to find targets to mine for precious metals in space on the moon and asteroids and things like that. So it is fascinating to see the actual real world applications of remote viewing. Now, let's step back a second in the conversation and let's what is the difference between, let's say, clairvoyance and remote viewing?
Well, I would describe it as clairvoyance is a description of being able to travel to a site and gather data just through sight. And you have clairaudience, where you hear things at the target site. But remote viewing, in essence, combines these capabilities into one discipline. So think of remote viewing as an overall term for being able to go out to a site or a person or a place or an event and bring data back to yourself. And the most important thing is documenting it. It doesn't do you any good to go to a target and go, oh, that's nice, without being able to provide a written or verbal description of what you saw. It's kind of like sending a reporter to a news event and they don't report anything back. You know, they don't do a broadcast or write a story or whatnot. So, from that aspect, going into applications, you know, the very first applications by the government was for intelligence purposes, intelligence collection. And the way that they were approaching remote viewing was it was a means by which you could obtain data that you could not obtain from any other source at the time. So couldn't use imagery to take a picture of it. There was no signals intelligence that would be able to listen to the communications. There was no measures and signature intelligence that would be able to tell you anything about the target. So And especially when you're looking at things that are in a enclosed area, take a picture of a building and like, okay, it's a building. What's going on inside?
Yeah.
And so one of the early successes in that application was Joe McMonagle being able to look inside an assembly building at a Russian ship building facility and start describing what eventually became the Soviet Typhoon submarine. And in the beginning, they disregarded what he was telling him because he was telling them things like he was seeing a double hull. He was seeing, 20 missile launchers in front of the sail.
Yeah.
Whereas normally missile boats all have their their missile tubes behind the sail. And his feedback was the Typhoon came out of the hull, and lo and behold, it was just like he described it.
Wow.
And so that's one of the key things about remote viewing is the importance of feedback to be able to, tell your mind that you were there, you were at the target site, you got the data on the target site, you were good, to reinforce that concept of you were there. And that's one of the key things about doing remote viewing is that when you do it and that first time you're successful, that aha moment, it's like it opens up a world for you because you yourself have done it. You yourself have experienced it and know it's real and it's not bullshit.
Yeah. And you couldn't use a better term. I think most people would want to ascribe to this, Greg. And it was one of those, I'm not going to say I was reticent, but I was definitely very curious about specifically the provability of such a thing. And once you start really digging into the data, you find out that as far as, any parapsychological quote science out there, it's really one of the only ones that is an actual science that has laboratory time put behind it to this extent.
That's why it's critical to read Dean Radin's works, where he lays out the scientific studies that show, yes, this is real. Yes, this exists. Yes, to his statistical significance level, it exists and is real.
Yeah.
And in some cases, more statistically significant than some of the holdings that are held in physics and other sciences. But the difficulty you run into and the difficulty the program ran into the whole time it was within the military and the intelligence community was what they call the woo-woo factor.
Yeah.
Which is you would go for funding and, you would run into people say, what, you want us to spend money on psychics?
Yeah.
Really? Which is why the term remote viewing was so critical, because it took it away from that woo-woo factor and said, no, this is an intelligence discipline that we have provable results that we can show you that it works. A great example was the military unit in 1979 was tasked with looking at the hostages being held in Tehran. And, what were their conditions and how were they feeling? And they were able to go in, especially on the hostages that they were thinking of releasing and going, okay, this particular individual, they're going to release because he has a medical condition. And they don't want to take a chance on him dying in custody. And sure enough, that individual was released. And he confirmed everything that they're able to find out about him. So that's one of the strengths of doing remote viewing is it gives you an opportunity to be able to look at the human target and understand what are the motivations, what are the plans. That's why from an intelligence perspective and human intelligence, one of the keys that you get from human intelligence is intent and planning and future operations that you may not get from your other intelligence sources like imagery and SIGINT and so on. So that's why remote viewing at that time was considered a human intelligence operation. But it was also because it was, you know, something new that they also had to undergo medical supervision, because in essence they looked at it as human experimentation. And so that was also part of the discipline of developing remote viewing for intelligence, was what was the impact on people? What was the impact on the viewers? And so a lot of great data out of that.
Well, and with that in mind specifically, because they're, once again, you don't necessarily have to go into a trance, so to speak. But you do have to kind of let things flow in an uninhibited way. And at least as somebody who practiced ecstatic prayer at one point in life, meditation, things like that, I find it very antithetical to those disciplines, you know, where once again, if you're trying to go through Buddhist meditation, you're not trying to account for the stray cats in your head. You're trying not to feed them. You know, you're trying to ignore them. Whereas the example that I give with remote viewing is almost like you want to give the monkeys bouncing in the trees a typewriter and just let them go, you know, because
part of that is the part of the discipline of control remote viewing is when you get those stray cats, as Lynn Buchanan has called them.
Yeah.
Or as others call it, analytic overlay. You acknowledge it. You just write it out, get it out of your system, take a little break, and then go back to the signal line.
Yeah.
And so that's part of that discipline of controlled remote viewing and going through the six stages that opens the aperture for the information wider and wider, and so that you're able to get more and more data out of it.
Yeah. And literally, this is where I think many other parasciences out there, Greg, can really take a leg up from the hard work done in 50 years of laboratory remote viewing and research into this topic. Because as you heard me say at the remote viewing cruise, like, paranormal is science. There's no difference. That's quite literally half of science is trying to figure out what that thing outside of the norm was that just happened in an experiment, you know? So the idea of those things being strangers is odd, but when you start tracking down the idea that the odd part is the not tracking it. And my favorite thing about remote viewing is that process of check-in at the beginning. And I think that is a huge part where other parasciences, other disciplines of paranormal study, could really begin their work in that kind of way, that personal check-in where it's like, what has been distracting me over the week? Basically, it's a filter check with remote viewing. It's the idea of what filters might I be processing this data through as it comes through to me, you know, like, yeah, me and my wife got in a fight and we didn't make up, you know, my dog ran away, things like that.
When you start a session, you know, you're laying out, you know, what are your personal inclemencies?
Yeah.
What are the things that are bothering you? What, you know, I don't feel really well today. Or when you said I had a fight with my spouse or significant other. And you note that and just let it go. And in essence, you're clearing the buffers of your mind of this extraneous data that can impact the signal that you're trying to pull in. And so, again, the other disciplines of remote viewing that I mentioned earlier, each has a different way of clearing those buffers.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's a focused way of acquiring data and recording data that can be used for a purpose, which is why we've gone past the research stage into the application stage of remote viewing. And, you know, there's some great books out there, especially by Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, that talks about the scientific analysis and studies that went into remote viewing, Again, Dean Braden, tremendous source on scientific studies of paranormal in general.
Yep.
So the remote viewing community as a whole has, in essence, said, enough. We don't have to prove it's real anymore. The skeptics are going to remain skeptical. Nothing we can do is going to convince them, so we're not going to bother trying anymore, other than doing studies to find out, how do I make it better? How do I make it more accurate? How do I make it broader? How do I get more data back? Ways of trying to record the data. One of the areas that IRVA is looking at now, especially the president, Deborah Katz, is how do I use artificial intelligence as a monitor for helping me do a remote viewing session.
And that was a fascinating presentation that Patty Gallagher and her gave at the cruise. And the idea of training an AI to be a remote viewing monitor, because honestly, to me anyway, monitoring is one of the most important parts of the process. I understand that numerous people out there remote view on their own, don't use a monitor, don't use a check system, things like that. And I get that. I understand that. For me, the science part of it is where you need a monitor. You know, because that monitor is who's going to keep you in check. That monitor is who's going to keep you on task during a session. They're the ones who are going to be like, seems like you're roaming into Stray Catville right now. You were talking about warm salt air. Let's go back to that, you know. And they really kind of keep you in check without once again leading you down a path. Or without
one of the key aspects of being a monitor is the viewer is always in charge of the session.
Mm.
Period. What a monitor can do is notice the micro movements that happen during a session, like you're entering the target and all of a sudden you just kind of back away and you don't consciously realize that.
Yeah.
But the monitor can see that and go, okay, you know, what are you feeling? What's the aesthetic impact you're going through right now? And open it up to, okay, I feel like I'm high over an open area. It just seems very wide and I'm very scary heights. And so they can notice things that happen to you physically while you're doing a session that you don't notice yourself. And that's why a monitor, especially when you're training, when you're starting out, you really need that monitor for that experience of guiding you through and helping you through the stages so that you're on track and you're getting the data back and helping you identify what is an AOL or analytic load overlay or a stray cat and so on. But for a lot of us, because we live so far from so many other viewers, a lot of times you end up having to go on your own.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, if you're lucky, you can get someone to be able to Skype or Zoom with you and watch you do your session, you know, remotely. But in my mind, having the monitor right there, who notices those micro movements and those reactions that are coming through to you that are being expressed through your bodily motions or your facial expressions that you normally wouldn't pick up over a camera. That to me is like the gold standard of a session, but reality is you don't always have that. And so you learn to do your sessions, you learn to kind of monitor yourself. And then you see, you know, what's the feedback?
I will definitely say that, of course, platforms like what we're on tonight with Skype, I get no money from Skype, folks. I also get no money from Zoom. Platforms like Zoom, things like that, have really, really changed the game as far as the means by which you can get training and have a monitor, you know. But for instance, hi, Tomy. My monitor lives in Hawaii. You know, yeah. I met her at Menlo Park. We became friends. And I will always say one of my favorite things about our sessions is the way that she can read me, Greg, because she's been a listener for like the last 2 years. So she watches me on camera. She sees me when I'm in a moment of, you know, like I was a minute ago, where I'm trying to find my place. I'm trying to find my words. So she recognizes those moments where there's something inside of me that I'm trying to get out and I can't get it out, or that I'm starting to get distracted and go down another path. So it's really interesting because, yes, it is a situation that, I believe so, that the better a monitor knows a person, I think the better the session is.
Well, and the other thing that you have to take into consideration is that there are times a telepathic link between the monitor and the viewer, so that a monitor can sense what you're seeing, what's going on, and be able to draw that out more easily.
Now, let's explore that for a second, because, of course, one of the things with remote viewing is that, of course, a monitor doesn't lead a session, and they don't lead the viewer by the questions that they pose. You know, that you're, it's basically like a conscious hypnosis session, you know, where you're trying to get information out without putting information into the system, so to speak.
Right. You're trying not to front load the viewer.
Yeah. So especially because that was one of the things I was very sad that me and my monitor did not get to hook up, because I have a brainwave headset. And I brought her the original version so that while we did our sessions, that we could record our brainwaves and see if our brainwaves actively synced up at a distance in that kind of way. You know, because is it possible for, I guess, because a monitor does know something about the target?
Not well. It depends on the session and okay. What you're doing.
Let's get into that.
If it's a training session or a standard operating session where time is not a factor, you want the monitor to be blind to the target the same as the viewer.
Okay.
And that's what the skeptics don't understand is that when you're doing a session, the only thing that you have to go on is an arbitrary identifier. That says the target is Q47, you know, modulator from Daffy Duck. But, you know, you have a string of numbers and letters that signify a target. And that's it. And you go into the session and you start getting the signal and you start, you know, putting down what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're smelling, what you're tasting, and that becomes data to build the session to where at the end, you know, you can have a summary that describes the target. And a monitor, ideally, is blind to the target as well. So all they're doing is watching the micro-reactions and where you seem to be starting to bring some information in but then dropped it. They can refer you back to that and say, okay, like you said, you were talking about smelling salt water.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that? And that way you're helping the viewer refocus on the session without prompting the viewer or, pushing the viewer in a specific direction. What the monitor is doing is helping you extract data from the session on the target.
Yeah.
Now, in some operational situations, you will need some front loading just because you got to make it quick. So, say for example, a missing person, and the front loading is the target is a person. Describe the location. So you don't have to go hunting around and going, okay, you know, am I seeing biologics at the site? You still haven't been told, you know, who the target is.
Yeah.
It just knows it's a person.
Yeah.
Where is it located? And then you start describing the location. And, you know, time is of the essence. That's one of the applications of remote viewing is in missing persons.
Yes, hugely.
So, you know, in 2019, Angela Thompson Smith, who Dr. Smith runs the Nevada Remote Viewing Group,
yep,
which I'm a member of, she does a lot of pro bono targets.
Yeah.
So we had a target of a hiker that was missing in Germany and Bavaria.
Oh, wow.
You know, where is the hiker? And so myself and Angela and a couple other viewers were able to focus on location. And we were able to look on a map and be able to pinpoint where the hiker was. And unfortunately, the hiker had died.
Oh, man.
So we were able to ascertain that, you know, the hiker was deceased. Here's the location of the remains. And the search party, which had been searching for a week for him, was able to go to him in a matter of hours.
Wow. Wow. And you know, that is something that Angela Thompson Smith is a great friend of the show. She's been on numerous times. I thoroughly enjoyed my time with her on the cruise as she was my monitor during the exercises. That was an incredible experience. And even and I think a prime example of the fact of a good monitor can monitor anybody. You know, you don't necessarily have to know them, but it can definitely help. And just the idea, once again, as Lynn Buchanan said numerous times on the show, like, you may think that you want to find missing children. Those things can kind of live in your head for a while, you know, and that is something that specifically when you're talking about something like an outbounder, a very specific type of remote viewing session where you are tying into somebody that is at a remote location. There's a specific way to tie into them and also a specific way to kind of cut those connections as you come back, you know.
Yeah, in some cases you have to detox after a session because, you know, what you've seen and experienced is not pleasant. The most recent case of that for a missing person was we were tasked by some folks in Argentina to locate a missing young person that had been kidnapped and was potentially being human trafficked.
Wow.
And so we were able to get a general location and describe the activities and describe the perpetrators. And that data was given to the police, and we were later told to kind of cease and desist because the cartel running it was looking for the people that were helping the police and remote viewers. So there is some, you know, downsides to doing missing persons, but that's also part of the application of remote viewing to things like criminal justice.
Yeah.
Pam Coronado, known as the psychic detective, has worked hundreds of cases of missing people and murders and so on. And she does wonderful instruction in remote viewing and being a psychic detective and being a medium. So you can go to her website and take courses in how to be a psychic detective.
Yep.
And she, you know, some of her famous cases was she was brought in by the authorities to help provide information on the D.C. Beltway sniper back in 2002.
Yep.
And people need to understand that as a remote viewer, you are not solving the case. You know, that's the police or the FBI or the U.S. Marshals, whoever. They're the ones that solve the case. You are just providing data to help them narrow down leads, to narrow down suspects. At one point, Lynn Buchanan had a program called an assigned witness. One of the interesting aspects of remote viewing is time is very malleable, and you are not bound by time. in a straight line. So you can go back in the past or you can go forward in the future.
Yeah.
And that's one of the applications of associative remote viewing that I'll talk about in a little bit. But Lynn had set up this program where the police would say, we had this murder, but we don't know how it happened. And he would, quote, assign a witness, a remote viewer or viewing team, to go to the incident at the time it happened and remote view it and describe, you know, the perpetrator or perpetrators, the victim, yeah. What happened, any data on what did the perpetrators look like, clothing, general appearance, what car were they driving, if anything. And that's just data that allows the police to be able to go through the mountain of data that they have and help narrow it down.
Yeah.
And I was involved in a case, again, with Angela. This was, I think, back in 2006. One of our friends and great friend of Irva is Robert Knight. And I don't know if you know of him, but he's mm-hmm. known as the photographer to the stars.
Yeah.
He's done photography of all the great rock stars. And you can see his work online and on Facebook and whatnot. He had a friend, a DJ from Denver called Steve Williams, that had gone missing. And he had asked Angela, you know, can you help me find him? And so Angela pulled together a team and we did sessions. And what we could observe was that we initially picked up on a deceased body, partially in the water near Catalina Island.
Wow.
And we told Robert this, and we described what we saw. And shortly thereafter, the police found the body, and they brought it in. And described the body, so if anybody knew him. And Robert immediately identified him as Steve and went down and told him, well, the body is this, has these features, and is missing a finger. And the police immediately saw him as a suspect.
Yeah.
And he says, no, I have friends that are able to see things and show them the data and the report that Andrew put together. And they were just kind of like, wow. And so we requested by Robert to press on, can we describe who the perpetrator was and what happened? And so we were able to describe the incident, how it occurred, what the perpetrator looked like, and where do we think the perpetrator is located now? And they were eventually able to locate the perpetrator in the general area that we saw him in another state. And he confessed to the murder.
Wow.
So
wow.
That is a practical application of remote viewing that we're able to help crime victims.
And
just by opening ourselves up to the data that's out there.
And that's just it. Being able to call through that data, being able to add to the data set and go through that in a scientific way is what this sets up for. And it's absolutely awesome when you see it leveraged and used in that kind of way. We've got you for about another 10, 15 minutes or so, Greg.
Sure.
Let's hit on the topic of associative remote viewing real quick, because I think that's where a lot of people unfortunately get lost. Whereas, you know, because that's where a lot of, I guess, prognostication, things like that can come in. This is where a lot of the things like the headline that I quoted in my talk, like, you know, do most people just know us from the silver market headline, where like they were predicting silver markets for about a year with great result, things like that. You know, like why isn't everybody just winning at horse racing? You know, why don't we see multi-million dollar remote viewers out there that are just like winning tickets in hand from the lottery? And I think that's a question that begs to bear on a lot of people's minds, Greg.
Okay, the difference between associative remote viewing and just controlled remote viewing is that in controlled remote viewing, you're actually going to a target site and describing the target. In associative remote viewing, you are describing your feedback. And what I mean by that is you are given a binary choice of who's going to win this football game.
Yep.
Is it team A or team B? And then you do a session of what do you think the photograph that is associated with the winning team looks like. And so the feedback is the team wins. You're shown the photograph and you go, oh, okay, I got it. Or no, I was completely off. Mm. But what you're trying to do is reinforce to yourself, you're picking up on a future event. You are, in essence, doing precognition through a disciplined manner of describe what you're going to see at your feedback. And there are other ways that you can help make that better, like, okay, you see the photograph for the correct target, eat a chocolate chip cookie.
Mm.
So when it comes time to do the viewing, you're getting that sensation of I'm describing the target and I'm getting the sensation of a chocolate chip cookie in my mouth. So I know I'm on the right track.
Interesting.
That's also a way that some students are able to do much better in tests because they're sending data back to their past selves. So you go into a test, you take the test, and you know, okay, I didn't do too well on these areas. And you, after the test, you study those areas, and then you try to send that information back to your past self for the test. And you do better on the test.
Interesting.
Yeah, now, that's part of, doing precognition of, election results.
Sure.
Who's going to win the election? In business applications and financials, like you described the silver markets, there are businesses that contract with remote viewers to tell them, how's the market going to do
yeah.
over a quarter? How's it going to do next year? We're thinking of maybe expanding into another area. What areas would be successful for us?
Yeah, should we go long on April wheat? Things like
right.
that.
And to those that say, no, you can't do that, the checks keep coming.
And
it's like Joe McMonagle has made a good living at looking for oil and gas and
yeah.
mineral deposits.
Yep.
And people have said, well, are you doing okay? Are you successful? And he goes, well, they keep sending me checks.
Yeah. Yeah,
so something's
I keep getting phone calls.
Yep.
And that's just it. When you start, because of course, take any statistics class, and you'll find out real quick the odds of catching a heads or a tails properly on a coin flip, and it's not actually 50-50. Once you start adding things in, and I think this is where a lot of people get lost, is that quantum aspect of time in the universe, Greg. And, the playful joke I made last time you were on the air, of course, we were chasing the tail end of a hurricane on a cruise ship. And it was like, none of the remote viewers saw the hurricane,
Well, if they did, they knew it wasn't going to be a problem.
And that's just it. There's that. And there's also the fact, much like you said in that interview, there is the quantum aspect of time mm-hmm. where especially when it comes to a futures market, whenever it comes to a game decision, something like that, a political decision, there are a lot of quantum aspects that go into whether or not that event comes out to play the same way that a viewer sees it.
Yeah. Well, an interesting group run by Daz Smith in the UK is called futureforecasters.com.
Okay.
And he has a team, one member who is Dick Allgaier, excellent viewer. He has some great viewers on his team. Task themselves with, okay, what's going to happen in the next month? What event is going to happen? And the most recent event that Dick had foreseen, the American Airlines crash at National Airport.
Wow.
So this is a group that is doing this for real and doing it for money. So if you want a future forecast done, you go to DAS's future forecasting site and you can lay your money down and they'll do future forecasts for you. And you can look at their track record of what they've done in the past. You can go on YouTube and see lots of sessions with Daz and Dick and other members of the team where they are going through and doing their session live on a whiteboard. And you can see, months down the road,
and it's
a headline.
It's pretty fascinating because there's been the idea of the eggs that were out for a while, like the random number generators that were looking at world events and basically doing predictive algorithm. And it was pretty fascinating. Like, well, that was one of the big things that happened up around 9/11 was that these random number generators all spiked at the same time.
The problem with the random event generator network is that it'll tell you an event is going to happen. It doesn't tell you what.
Yeah.
It just says, we're noticing a change in random event generators around the world, and it's okay, something's going to happen, but you have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
And that's another aspect of these abilities, is this remote influencing.
Let's get into that in the last few minutes, because I think that's probably the juicy nugget. I go to Vegas 5 times a year for work, man. How do I make the dice turn? You know, how do you make it land on double zero on the roulette wheel, you know?
You talk to Glenn Wheaton in the Hawaii Remote Viewing Guild.
Right.
And, the casinos were not happy when IRBA has its annual conference in Vegas, because one of the fun things you do is go down to the roulette wheel and you bet red or black. And sometimes you can influence the ball to hit what color you want.
Wow.
And sometimes you can influence dice, too. And there have been a couple times in the past where folks have been asked to please move on to another casino.
Sure.
So you try not to be obvious about it. But
it's kind of like counting cards. Not necessarily illegal. Like, prove I'm fluencing the dice, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, there's been a history of this. That's one of the things that got Ingo and Hal Putoff started on trying to figure out psi and remote viewing was, back in 1972, Ingo was visiting Hal. And Hal took him to another laboratory within SRI that was studying quarks. And they had a magnetometer that was buried deep in the ground that was shielded, looking for quarks to come through. And Hal asked Ingo, can you take a look at that? And Ingo remote viewed it, and the magnetometer started going crazy.
Yeah.
And he stopped, and the magnetometer went back to normal.
Interesting.
And Hal said, can you do that again? And Ingo said, sure. And he remote viewed the magnetometer, and it started going crazy. And he got thrown out of the lab.
Yeah. Well, and once again, when it comes to that idea of remote influencing, Greg, I remember specifically when we've had Lynn Buchanan on, he was like, we had protocols not to remote influence within our program. Like, it was not allowed, you know, and he was like, it wasn't for a want or a want of not wanting to take down an enemy or something, but just the fact of like the pure ethics involved with it. and yeah. and the idea of, yeah, you could kind of, I guess, like Stephen King in Firestarter with the shop, like push somebody to do something, you know, and for some people of some Psy influence out there, it would not be a hard thing for them to do. You know, yeah. I mean, I'm sure if Lem Buchanan can influence and break a military computer via distance, I'm yes. sure he could make you want to eat a bowl of Fruit Loops too. You know, like, but that's the that's where it comes in, because once again, you know, sure, I guess every associative remote viewer out there could go out and just, you know, make millions, but what is the ethical propensity behind that, you know, and are you now using these gifts in an ethical way?
Well, I would say yes, because anybody can learn to do associative remote viewing. Again, it goes back to not, you know, everybody can learn to play golf. Not everybody's going to be Tiger Woods.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
People can learn to remote view, but they're not going to be Joe McMonagle.
That's right. That's right. You probably won't be shaking magnetometers underneath a lab in your first few yeah. years of doing something.
Yeah, you're not going to be an Ingo Swann yeah. or Joe McMonagle or, you know, a Lynn Buchanan or a Paul Smith or an Angela Thompson Smith.
Yeah.
But, you know, think of another aspect of remote influencing. What is prayer?
Mm.
You yep. have prayer circles for people having medical problems, and those problems are resolved.
Even the idea, which we bring up in the next segment with our next guest, the idea of psychosomatic illness, mm-hmm. Greg, the idea of lifting boils on your skin because you're so hypochondriacal yeah. about things.
Well, and that's another application of remote viewing that you can do is medical assessment. Gail Husick of the Husick yeah. Group did a study on a family with autism and trying to understand, you know, what caused the autism, how is the autistic child doing, can you establish communications with a child with autism?
Yes.
And they were able to do that. And then you look at Lynn Buchanan and his methodology for assessing a human body or any medical issues within yeah. the body, that's able to guide, you know, medical personnel trained in the standard, you know, MD, OD, those kinds of folks,
yep.
into, okay, we perceive the problem to be here, and that gives them a focal point to do testing and be able to see. Yes, there's a problem.
You know, my brain just started cooking real fast, man, on the idea of the communicating with the non-communicative, especially just coming from a family whose mom worked with special ed and autistic mm-hmm. kids and things like that. But even whenever you're talking about stroke victims, things yep. like that, you know, the idea of and even people in a coma, the idea of being able to connect with them via distance in a different way and to be able to interpret the world through the way that they see it and give another unique perspective to a doctor or a therapist.
Yeah, that even is Elon fantastic Musk is talking about using Neuralink
yeah.
as a means for people that have had strokes or in a coma to be able to continue to communicate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Greg, thank you so much for your time tonight, man. This was an amazing peeling back of the curtain on the topic of remote viewing. I've got to have you back on again and again, of course, to really get into this nails deep on the different topics and different forms of remote viewing. If you folks have enjoyed this, feel free to come on out to the upcoming Symposium of the Strange in San Antonio. Greg will be our speaker, and he'll be going much more into depth about the government remote viewing program, the world of intelligentsia and remote viewing, and a lot of these other applications. Greg, thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate
it. Oh, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you, Chris. Thanks very much for having me on.
Absolutely. Anytime and always. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow work, where they can go to keep up, where they can go to find out more about the world of remote viewing, Greg.
Oh, highly recommend going to the International Remote Viewing Association, IRVA.org. You can contact me through IRVA. I have an email address there. And IRVA, the website, is just awash with, resources and capabilities for you to learn about remote viewing and understand remote viewing. The education program, I've taken part in some of those where we talk about the different aspects of remote viewing. There's 2025, we're going to be in Alamogordo, New Mexico.
Right.
That's stomping grounds for Lynn Buchanan. And I would recommend coming to the conference and meeting a lot of fascinating individuals.
It is honestly one of the greatest communities that I get to be a part of across the country, Greg, when it comes to events.
Yeah.
It really is a group of people who are in this for the same purpose. And in this, for the sake of science and the scientific endeavor of it, it's absolutely fantastic. So,
yeah, and understand it is international.
That's right.
We have groups in Europe and South America and Asia that are all working on as part of IRVA.
Yeah,
and contributing to the knowledge there. So, definitely check it out. I think you'll be impressed.
It is nothing but awesome. And once again, I am a proud lifetime member of IRVA. I firmly support everything that they do toward the scientific endeavor of this topic. And I am here to help further that as much as possible. Greg, thank you so much once again for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff in very short order. So you have a great evening tonight, my friend.
You too. Take care.
All right. Take care. While you are online checking out everything from the International Remote Viewing Association at IRVA.org, as well as getting your tickets to the upcoming conference in Alamogordo, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the episodes, as well as the store. If you are a researcher out there in the world of paranormal, in the world of, cryptids, UFOs, UAPs, stop on by the Curious Realm store and get your copy of the official Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. It is your way to have a pocket data log while you are out doing investigations to write your data down in real time to prepare it to shake hands with science. Come that day. When we come back from our quick commercial break, folks, we will be joined by our good friend Anne Celine. We will be discussing the world of psychology and the paranormal, where these two things meet, how our brains actively search for patterns, how the world of belief and the parapsychological belief comes to be. So we'll be getting into that and more with Anne Celine right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to Greg Redabaugh from Bear Consulting. It's always fascinating talking with him about the world of remote viewing and how that relates to the world around us, not just technologically, but in the world of intelligentsia and in the world of politics, everything else. So interesting stuff. Thank you so much to Greg Redabaugh for that. Also, thank you so much to True Hemp Science, our sponsor. Stop on by True Hemp Science today, folks. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to visit. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. True Hemp Science makes amazing CBD products using a spigyric process, using every part of the plant, stems, seeds, buds. Every part is used, reused, combusted, and used again until nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum CBD product. Once again, stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles for free as well. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Ann Saleen. We will be talking about paranormal, and not just paranormal, but how paranormal relates to psychology, which is, as many of you know, one of my favorite topics. The idea of abnormal psychology, the idea of how our brain works, and how that relates to the world of the paranormal as we know it, and to ongoing and future paranormal research. So welcome back to the show, Ann Saleen. How are you?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love being here with you. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing okay. You know, been in Hawaii and all kinds of stuff, traveling around. So it's nice to be back here in the studio and actively live and doing all that kind of fun stuff. But you have made a large pivot recently in a lot of your work, you know, and I'm loving it. I'm loving it because we've talked numerous times. We've had you on talking about the world of manifestation, how to manifest things in life. And I am a big believer in not only manifestation, but in the way that our brain works when we are manifesting. And one of the things that I have posited and posed not only on the show, but live whenever I speak, is the idea that is behind what we were just talking about, remote viewing. That concept that Hal Puthoff, a laser scientist, put out so many years ago that could we be affecting our experiment when we go home and think about it? You know, the idea that our thoughts actively affect the world around us. The idea if you're driving to work and you go, man, did I leave the iron on? And you think it long enough and hard enough that your iron turns on and burns the apartment down, you know?
Right.
And it sounds like a Time Life series, you know, it sounds like, you know, a woman in Poughkeepsie had a dream about her twin sister. That day, her sister was hit by a bus, you know, but it's fascinating. And even whenever you get into the world of synchronicities and learning to recognize those and see those, that is once again another deep psychological concept once you start digging into Carl Jung and his work. Yeah. So contrary as it may seem, the world of paranormal and psychology are hand in hand.
Exactly. Well, and based off of what you said too, I can't remember if this is proper. I'm sure you will have the knowledge. But wasn't it called the double split experiment where they observed the particles and it changed the behavior because it was observed?
Yeah.
So we have things in science that prove that observation or paying attention to something can change an outcome.
Yeah.
So I do believe that when we think about something, it definitely changes it depending on how we're thinking about it. And it's something that I've seen countless times in my own life. And we can talk about even, you know, in regards to if we're, you know, feeling really negative that day and how that radiates out, you know, all of a sudden you're going to be hitting a bunch of red lights on your way to work. I mean, there's a lot of tangible real world results that happen from negative thinking and from positive thinking as well. So I really do believe that our mind somehow scientifically is tapped into the world around us. And I don't think that, because a lot of people want to put the word magic on manifestation.
Yes. Yes.
But it's not. It's a science that we haven't discovered yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And really it's a true connection to the world around us. And I think a very large expression of quantum physics, you know, the idea of you and I, despite the fact that you're in San Antonio right now and I'm in Austin, we're sharing an electron shell. We're still sharing similar space despite our distance, according to all quantum theory. According to all ninth grade science, where you learn like you're 90% empty space. An atom is 90% empty space between the electron and the nucleus, you know? So if that's the case, then how solid are we in all actuality? You know, so it's not necessarily that we're weaving magic, but more that we're aligning with the vibration that's already there.
Right. No, I agree with that. And it, you know, when you take that and then you start to really think about the human mind and how the mind works, number one, it's so fallible and it's desperate to put together a story. And we are so influenced by the things that we read, by the TV shows that we watch. And I think, depending on how we go about it, if we could learn where our mind is creating the paranormal. And I want to be careful how I phrase this, because
absolutely,
I think that we are part of the paranormal. We create it, but it also exists outside of us. And trying to figure out where it is that we created it versus where it was that we didn't create it is where you can really find the true paranormal experience, if you will. And maybe I'm not making sense, but I'll use an example. You have a childhood memory where you believe that you encountered an ET of some sort. And this is an abduction experience, let's say. But you don't really have a lot of the details. And so you go in and you have a hypnotic regression. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the questions that are asked are a bit leading. And the mind is really wanting to put together that picture. So then the mind is actively creating things. But it's creating things that has been pulled from, you know, your subconscious, different things that you've seen, maybe the collective unconscious, and it's, you know, creating the story. Well, and this is not to invalidate anybody that has had an abduction experience as a child, but there are times when we look at trauma psychology, that the mind will want to create a totally different scenario, one that might even be more fantastical and out there, because the real truth is a lot worse. I mean, I know that wouldn't you rather think that an alien brought you on its spaceship instead of thinking that you were abused by a beloved family member?
Yeah. Sure.
So if we can understand that the human mind is capable of this, and then we try to dive into what else the human mind is capable of, we can use that when we're looking into different paranormal experiences and differentiate where it might have been the mind, you know, the yeah. mind's creation versus something that was actually paranormal.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. We recently, just last week, had Billy Joe Kane from Radical Empathy Education Foundation on, talking about the world of building empathy with victims through virtual reality, and the idea of trying to get somebody to understand what it's like to be in a victim's shoes.
Right.
So that you can better understand and identify victims without, once again, as you were saying, having the confrontational questions, you know, right. because there is a way by which you can talk to victims that you can without having confrontational or judgmental phrasing, you know, and police are very, very well trained in that. Detectives specifically are very well trained in non-confrontational question asking because it doesn't pigeonhole somebody. It doesn't make them feel as though they're being attacked as they're asking the question, things like that. And it's hugely used, especially in MUFON ERT, the Experiencer Resource Team, things like that uses a lot of those. So the idea of being able to understand that, yes, somebody has been through a traumatic situation. And unfortunately, yeah, their mind may have guised their traumatic situation that happened with them, that something that they believe would be acceptable, you know, even though it may still be a violation, it's not as much as a life-breaking violation in that kind of way. You know,
right. Well, and this is where I get pretty passionate because I was trying to write out a paper and I'm still in the midst of it. But it's about the ethical approaches that we should be taking as paranormal researchers. And, you know, we're not psychologists. I understand that. We have not been trained in that. Sure. However, we are taking on that role when experiencers come to us and say, you know, I've had this traumatic experience. And the way that we respond on that is so important because we have the ability to either soothe them or cause really bad cognitive dissonance, which is, you know, conflicting thoughts and feelings within, which can make you feel like you're just full of so much turmoil. There's the ambiguity and tolerance because we don't have the answers. We don't. And you have to deliver this in a way that it's okay if you don't have all the answers and you're not going to go into this spiral. And, you know, if you can't find the, you know, the absolute.
Yeah.
And I don't think enough people take any of that into consideration when they're doing interviews, when they have people come up to their table. I mean, you can, for instance, you can have somebody come up to you and say, oh, I've had multiple experiences and I've had an experience with a Wendigo and a dogman and a Kentucky goblin or whatever. And if you ask something in return, say, well, why do you think that you've had multiple experiences?
Yeah.
Now, I understand that you may be curious of why this person thinks that. I get it. But the response to that can be this person now is feeling completely criticized.
Yeah.
Now they're questioning, you know, like, did you just question my belief? Did you question who I am as a person? And I mean, no, we shouldn't have to walk on eggshells, but we should all at least have some kind of a basic education that teaches us at least a certain amount of protocol. So that way we know how to handle when there are the extreme cases and people that are coming up to you crying or saying that they've had multiple experiences.
Well, and you know, of course, researcher or no researcher, that's a tough situation to handle, period. And for years, and I guess it's one of the reasons why they were kind of considering me in the world of confessor whenever I was going for a collar. because yeah. people randomly come up to me and just tell me everything. Like strangers.
You have that energy.
And it's fascinating. But not everybody can handle that. Not everybody's prepared for that. You know, and yeah, whenever you're sitting at a table or working a conference, there's a lot of that that goes on. And that can be hard to veil, so to speak, yes. As far as like controlling your energy as you respond to that. You know, that right. can take a lot of practice to keep yourself reined in and to understand that, once again, the experience is where science starts.
Right.
You know, the only question is, did you hop on the train of science or did you stay at the station of experience? You
right.
know, and you can stay at the station of experience and like eat Twix from the vending machine, have some Chick-fil-A, whatever. But the science right. train just left and mm-hmm. your experience like put the coal in the fire to move that train. So, the question does come to bear. Did you, after your experience, start putting science to it? Did you start going through and even just following the scientific method, the idea of experience, gathering more data on the topic, mm-hmm. you know, and critically looking at that data, not cherry picking data, not just choosing data that fits your paradigm or that fits your right. answer or that fits your hypothesis. But having someone that, you know, and you and I have talked privately numerous times about things like this, mm-hmm. where it's like, I consider you somebody that I could definitely take data to. And if you had question about it, I would seriously consider those questions, you know, and we have to be willing to do that. We have to be willing to do that even with private experience, you know, horribly and awfully enough. Even when abuses happen in a home and the experience of two siblings can be vastly different, even within that cycle of abuse, you know, and the way that they view things can be entirely different. The way that they identify with that. And like we got into with Billy Joe Kane last week, you know, people ask like, why do you say there's something that happens. Even whenever you're an experiencer that it changes you in a different way and it charges you in a different way. And I'm about to pop an article up from the National Institute of Health. This literally came out shortly after COVID, talking about protecting the brain against bad news. And the idea that while we were all locked away during COVID, we were exposed to a news cycle daily, whether you were on social media or not, you were exposed to a daily barrage of news and news that was not happy. News of thousands of people dying, things like that. Now, bear with me, folks, because what that does is it actively damages the hippocampus of your brain.
Yes.
It bruises the hippocampus of your brain, which is the soft velvety glove that surrounds the amygdala, which is the fight or flight center of your brain. So this is basically the filter through which we rationally judge the way things happen to us and whether or not we react to them like a reptile and snap.
Yep.
Like an alligator, or whether we're calm and relaxed and view it through a rational lens. So the fact that we were all exposed to this and the fact that once again, it's the impulse to consume negative news can be difficult to resist. Is literally one of the things that they say.
Right.
So here's a study telling you that your want in your brain is to go to that negative place.
Right.
Is to go to that. And horribly, when you go there, you bruise your brain enough that it's easier to go there.
See?
And that you want to go there more than to be happy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, so I've been learning a lot about those areas of the brain through EMDR. And when we're talking to people, I think that it'd be really interesting doing a history intake of somebody who has had an experience if they've had childhood trauma, because it, when you have childhood trauma before the age of 8, while this area of the brain is still developing, I mean, it changes. It changes things.
Yeah.
And it affects you for the rest of your life. But through EMDR, you can start to regrow and fix that. Which EMDR is the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a type of therapy that, you know, you'll be doing something like, let's say your eyes are closed and you're thinking of a traumatic memory and you're tapping your hands back and forth. And it basically helps kind of rewire things in the brain and reprocess memories where they have been kind of lost and fragmented and buried. But, and before I forget too, because there was another comment that popped in my head as you were talking, in regards to our getting angry, the feelings of upset, I think that it would be a really interesting thing. I'd love to challenge researchers to do this. When you have someone at your table and they come up to you and they're telling you a story, and let's say you immediately scoff it off, or they annoy you, or they trigger something in you that you're just like, that person's, you know, whatever, because we're human.
Yeah.
And that does happen.
It does.
And I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
My challenge is self-reflect on why that hit you the way it did.
Yeah.
Because you know what? If you face that and you think about that, it's going to change you as a researcher.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting to go a little bit into some of the conversation that we were having before the show. There's a reticence amongst a lot of research communities, Anne, a huge reticence to share data. And that fascinates me. Mm-hmm. It fascinates me because it brings me back to the point of college and my friends who were like in molecular biology and going for these advanced degrees and vying for a summer program at Chapel Hill to go get into their master's program, you know, which would lead to all kinds of jobs. And the fact of people literally sabotaging another person's experiment in order to be the one who wins. And it's so hilariously horrifying that is the case, that like, that is the mentality of science, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, here is what's supposed to be this, and it, literally one of the only communistic bones in my body. I'm as you've seen me work. I am as capitalist as you can get, Jack. I don't care who I push buttons for. Does the button work? And does the image go on screen? And does the check clear? That those are my three questions for a gig.
Right.
There's very few things that I like morally object to. I remember when I first moved home from Maine, I was doing a video project, and the third interview, the people got to me and they were like, okay, so we just want you to know this is for like a homosexual dating website. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Like sipping my coffee. And they're like, do you have a problem with that? I'm like, does your check clear?
Right.
Like,
right.
I don't care what you do with this footage or what your like, this is America, man. go start your website, do your thing. But the frightening, horrible fact is science doesn't work that way frequently. Frequently, there is a competition and a race to who gets the data first, to who releases it first, and things like that. And that is not communistic science. That's not science for the sake of open community and sharing of data. That is a competitive view of science. And I think sadly, especially when it comes to other researchers talking to other researchers, a lot of that comes with, I'm glad they're not on the trail of clues I am.
Right.
You know, 'cause I'm going to get to it first.
And here again, I want to challenge them and say, why?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you need to be the gatekeeper? Why is it that you need to be the one that yes. figures out whatever? You know, with the path that I'm on currently with the psychology and manifestation and stuff, somebody could take my work, you know, find out about it first or try to, you know, speed roll onto the, you know, platform to say, I figured this out or whatever. Good. Fine. I don't care how the information gets out there. As long as it's out there and we can start seeing a change. And so here again, if you're somebody that has to be the one that you're wanting to come out with this new, you know, whatever cutting edge you want to be, why? Yeah. Why is that so important to you? What kind of damage or, you know, like, how do I say?
Well, what's the psychological
insecurity?
Need?
Insecurity.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of insecurity do you have that's what you have to be? That you have
to go heal that and then come back to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those, like, it isn't helping science and it isn't helping a lot of the communities because it definitely does become a point of popularity and competition. Yeah. You know, and not too long ago, it was hilarious to me that AI actively pulled the clip. But I was interviewing Michael J.S. Carter and just had a revelation, you know, minister, former minister to be talking to an actual minister. And it was like, wow, it just hit me why I don't have like hundreds of thousands of views every week. It's because scientifically I am lukewarm. When it comes to these topics, research wise, I am lukewarm. I'm very passionate about being lukewarm because that's what science is. You know,
right.
I don't follow the conspiracy trail. I demystify the reasons why a conspiracy exists, you know, and I'll talk about what the actual things are that people are pulling down the conspiracy trail. And I will deconstruct that, but I'm not going to go down a trail of panic and just sell people fear because of my knowledge of that NIH study. And protecting the brain against bad news, you know, like I know what the psychological dangers are by doing that, you know, and there are many in a lot of these things. And we have to be careful, even as a host. I have to be careful what I say and how I say it, because there are people who listen to me.
Right.
And if I say, like, you are being stalked by aliens in the night and they're here to take your DNA and your children. That's a definite, that's a black and white. And that's not science. That's not reporting, folks. Just so you know, we can't say that in absolute. And when somebody is speaking in absolutes, make no mistake, they are no prophet.
Right.
A prophet always provides a way out. There's always a way out with a prophet.
It's so fascinating to me, though, how intoxicating it is to people to be a part of conspiracies, to be a part of the negativity. It's kind of like it's on the same train as, you know, sex sells, you know, fear sells. It's and people just want to keep coming back to it. So I'll ask a question here,
please,
because I'm not sure. You know, I know that when we are on social media and we make a post and maybe it's a selfie or whatever, and somebody comments on it really nicely, that's a dopamine hit.
Yeah.
But what it's not still dopamine, is it? If they're like, ooh, I'm going to, you know, grab onto this next conspiracy and get myself lost in it. What chemical is that that's making them addicted to staying within that fear state and that wanting to come back to all of that?
That's cortisol.
Cortisol?
Cortisol is the hormone that is released by your brain during panic, during fear. So that's what I've always said about the mini shows that are out there that talk about the doom, and like, you are creating cortisol junkies. They pump you full of cortisol. They pump you full of cortisol, and then they go to commercial break and sell you a solution for what they just pumped you full of cortisol about.
Right.
That's
That's incredible.
That's how that works. So yeah, the cortisol is just as addictive as serotonin.
Just as
addictive. Like you can, no different than being addicted to the pain in your body that you have manifested through psychosomatic means.
Right.
You know?
Ugh, right.
That's a cortisol hit. And those things are real, folks. They are real, real things. And they can lead to addictive places. I mean, there it is right there about the negative spiral. You know, acute stress reactions and some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder that can be quite long-lasting. These are the things that come from living in a negative cycle. So if you want to talk about manifestation, that's the easiest, most sure, self-fulfilling prophecy means to it. Feel free to think negatively all day long and see if your brain doesn't want to think negative all day long. Like it's a fight to stay positive in this world. It's
a fight. And you brought up something that is, you know, really interesting to me that I've recently learned about as well. And this is, you know, the somatic, you know, how the body stores trauma. There was a book that I ended up finding, and it says, what's the title of it? The Body Keeps the Score. How the Body Keeps the Score.
Okay.
I believe. And it talks about how we may have an experience in childhood and maybe our brain, you know, covers it up, but we always have some kind of a strange pain that we don't realize where it came from. You know, whether it's a pain in your lower back or your hip or whatever, and it's all these years later. Or if you're going to therapy and then all of a sudden your body is in physical pain.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there going, where is this coming from? But it's actually your body releasing the stored trauma. Yes. Thank you so much. It's that. And I will say, this book must be consumed like a rare, expensive truffle. You cannot read this from front to back. Yeah. Like you have to take it in little bits because you're going to be processing as you're reading through this book. Your body's going to start, you know, healing and things will come to the surface. So I will give that warning, but it is essential. It has helped me a lot. And here again, I wonder if some people that have had, let's just say, alien abduction experiences, and they still have certain feelings in certain parts of their body, is it from that? Or is it stored trauma from something else that your brain, you know, put a different story on? You know, these are things we have to consider as researchers.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of interesting because once again, our brains release so many things. They do so many things. And they are pattern seeking machines. It's what they are. It's where pareidolia comes from, things like that. But specifically patterns in how you think are more important than anything. A prime example, I'll bring up another National Institute of Health study, folks,
awesome.
About oxytocin during the initial stages of romantic attachment.
Oh.
And the fact that literally, and this is, no, it sounds strange. Used to teach 7th and 8th graders sex and sexuality. You know, it was not only sexual education, but the idea of what do you do with your sexuality in the world around you? And this was one of the big things that we would bring up all the time is that casual sex, what have you, hey, no judgment. Just remember this. Your brain actively releases the same chemical that it does when you're with your mate for life.
Yep.
When you find a girlfriend and love her romantically. Everything else. So whether or not your brain is thinking that you are romantically attached to this person, your body and your hormones are fully telling you that you are mentally attached to the person that you are casually having sex with.
See, and this is so important. It is so vital because I remember having sex ed. I think I was in, sophomore year or junior year.
Yeah.
I know that it wasn't my freshman year. So sophomore or junior. And they didn't teach anything near that. It was just like, this is the way the baby develops.
Here's a condom. How you put a condom on.
Yeah.
Like that. But the idea of, once again, right there, the inability to maintain intimate bonds has been associated with physical and emotional distress. So when you're talking about even the distress of, quote, losing your virginity, the stress of that situation, you are now tying that situation and that feeling to the release of oxytocin in your brain, which is only released during moments of connection. Like, that's what's released in a mother's brain when she is breastfeeding a child that makes her want to give her life to save that baby.
Yeah.
You know? So when you think about those things, when you think about the way that that situation now drives you and what your brain has now hormonally tied to a thought.
Yeah.
There's a totally different thing there. And when you start considering that, even when it comes to love and attachment to these topics.
Yeah.
There's still oxytocin released. You know? Not in a romantic way, but in a connection way. Right. Oxytocin, once again, is that hormone of connection and being connected to somebody. And that idea of, you know, I just met this person at a conference and we talked about our experiences and I feel very, very deeply connected to them now.
Right. Well, and that's where it can get a little bit, I don't want to use the word dangerous, but something that needs to be looked at, because one of the things that I've seen is people will come into the community and maybe they felt like outsiders, and all of a sudden their stories are being listened to and they're new, and this buzz of the newness and the attention that they're getting, eventually for us all, it starts to dissipate because our stories have been around. And now that's getting less and less and less. And I have seen people where they will try and they're trying to seek more, to come up with another experience, another story, another whatever, because they feel the need to be relevant. And I'm going to be honest here, but I think that there's a bit of carrion beetle stuff going on with how fast, you know, stuff is consumed and how people are just, we want more, you know, a podcast will end and right before the credits even roll, people are like, what's going to be on the next one? And so there's this pressure to continually have more happening and more going on. And with that pressure, sometimes people will, you know, be untrue.
Sure.
And then our field can become muddied from this.
Well, and I have up on screen some more of the results of that study of connection, where it talks about high individual stability, you know, that 6 months later, many of these people show a decreased level of stability, and no different than trying to continually impress somebody in a relationship. Eventually, it's kind of like I caught myself on fire for the end of Dudes and Beer. What do I do now?
Right.
How do you top setting yourself on fire? Like skin dive with great whites with a stake tied around your neck? Like, what? Right. How do you top that? You know? So there's a point where, same as dating somebody. There's that old Chris Rock phase, you know, for the first 6 months, you're dating somebody's representative.
Yeah,
are you really dating the actual person? Do you know all of their intimates? Have they told you all of their intimates? Do they trust you enough to tell you about the kid that they had in college? You know, yeah. Things like that, that doesn't live with them and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Or do you find that out 6 months later? You know, do we, and a horrible, horrible example of this, Anne, do we let things like Corey Good continue to happen? Where Corey Good is brought into a community, and once again, no dissing anybody's experiences who are out there, okay? I am right. Talking about one man, one individual, the experiences he claimed to have that he right. said were real in numerous interviews. And when people came up to him at conferences and came up to his table and let me buy your book and have you sign it, I had the same experience. Oh my God, really? That's insane. I can't believe you had the same experience as me. Confirming their experience.
Right.
Only to find out years later that he is an utter charlatan, that his right. experience was, quote, channeled. And yeah. hey, I have numerous people on this show that come on and talk about channeled stuff. I've had Bashar on my show. All right.
right.
I got no problem with talking about somebody about channeled information when they are saying prima facie, this information is channeled.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you say this is a fact, it happened to me in life. This is what happened to me as a child. And you take other people down that rabbit hole and confirm. Yeah. their beliefs, and then later in a deposition say anybody who says that they've had this experience, they are delusional. So how long did you feed their delusion in order to make your money?
Oh, yeah. No, and, it's
that's
horrible.
The disturbing
it's
part of it.
It's horrible on so many levels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing, is that those abuses can happen, and those abuses do happen. And it's horrible. It's horrible because it does take advantage of people who have had an experience of something in their life and are looking for that connection, that oxytocin right. connection with another experiencer, with somebody else who has also felt this, who's also had this, you know?
Right. Well, and it's what's really bad, too, is when you have the people who really believe in their experience.
Absolutely.
And I've seen there was somebody I watched.
Names aren't important. We need no names.
Yeah. There was an experience being talked about and I could tell that it was a very genuine, like this person really believed what was happening. But at yeah. the same time, when you look at it through a psychological view and this person said, these people will think I'm crazy, but I'm not, because, and there was a statement yeah. that was very like, it was almost like this person needed to hear it themselves to try to convince themselves that they were not. And what was really interesting is it was just this almost in like inner turmoil being played out.
Mm.
during this presentation, and you knew that this was not a genuine, this was a fabricated thing, and it was sad, and nobody's willing to talk or say anything, but at the same time, how do you? And yeah, so those cases are very, very delicate.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, they eventually all come to bear themselves, you know, much like Corey. There have been yeah. a few of them in the communities over the last couple of years, you know, and even now, from what I see to be hit pieces being right. made in the community, you know, like the Brooklyn Bridge UFO story that came out on Netflix. Where it's like, yo, you contacted a researcher who was pretty hip deep in this and was an understudy of the man who did the research, as well as mm-hmm. the experiencer, contacted them, told them a totally different story about how you were going to portray this.
Right.
interviewed them and used it in a totally opposite way. I see those as not only hit pieces on those people, but specifically hit pieces within the community, where it's like, how do you rebuild a layer of trust with experiencers now to come forward and to maybe not be treated like that one day, to have my whole experience. And, you know, once again, I say it on the show all the time. Experience is where science starts. And even if you come to a point of somebody fully explaining what is inside of the red circle of the picture that you took,
right,
that does not remove your experience.
Right.
That does not change your experience and the way it changed you.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Doesn't. Even if, you know, things are shown along the lines of psychology to come to bear that what you thought from your childhood wasn't necessarily what happened in your childhood. Even if it's abuses, things like that, that you come to find out were, actually just continuations of things in my brain, that were not actual abuses that happened. That doesn't change you. That doesn't change the perception that you had, and it doesn't change the person that you have become because of the perceptions that you've had.
Right.
What it does is hopefully open a door of conversation within your mind to further explore those.
Oh, yeah.
And further explore how that happened along the way, and how your brain adopted these things in the way that it did.
Right. No, I agree with that. And that's, if I could wish one thing for everybody in the community, it would be that, to be able to explore yourself, explore your mind, and not be afraid that if you did get something wrong or if you misperceived something, you know, to find out that, you know, instead of a encounter with a dog man, it was an encounter with an armed robber, you know, whatever it was. That's healing.
Yeah.
You're realizing that this is something like, oh, I had a breakthrough. And now from this breakthrough, I can, you know, do ABC. But one thing I also know is that people tie traumas and everything to their identity.
Yeah.
But we're not. That's not our identity.
Hey,
it's just a piece of us.
Absolutely. You know, and I fully identify with that. I literally just explained to a friend who was like, hey, how you doing? Like, you just came back from Hawaii. How you doing?
Yeah.
And I was like, extraordinarily depressed.
Yeah.
You know, just off the cuff, being honest with a friend, you know, like, believe it or not, pretty ragingly depressed right now. You know, had a few things that ain't really working out the way that I thought that they would, whatnot. But I also go through doldrums throughout the year. And part of that is reticent from my time in the seminary and how my journey of that was treated through my life and things that happened to me afterward, you know, that I fully committed to myself. You know, utterly self-imposed. Even now, the thought of those things is fully self-imposed, Dan. But to realize the fact that this small 3-4 day spout that I'm going to go through is tied to that from years ago and being able to recognize that and just go, oh, hey, old friend, how you doing? You'll be there for 3 or 4 days and I'll power through you. You know, recognizing it prima facie for what it is and not letting it control me, letting it drag me somewhere else. But you've got to be willing to explore that. You've got to be willing to explore even how your modern day is still tied in some psychological way to the injuries that happened to you years ago.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's very much like, you know, so, okay. Rephrasing things.
Sure.
In regards to, like, instead of saying, Because the thing is you are not your depression.
Yes.
You're experiencing the depression.
Exactly.
And then if you can look at it as like, oh, I'm experiencing depression right now. What has it come to teach me?
Yep. Yeah.
And so if we can look at our anxieties or depressions, or even when our body becomes ill and it's painful and everything, if we take that time to recognize, oh, my body is asking me to rest. My body is asking me to go within and kind of quiet the hum of the, you know, the craziness without.
Yeah.
And not many people want to do that. It's scary. And I understand that. But when we do, that is where real healing can begin.
Yeah.
And then here we go, circling all the way back to the very beginning of this. Once we do that and we can heal ourselves, then it goes outward into the world. That's and right. Now we're affecting everybody around us. We're not projecting that negativity and getting all the, you know, red lights or getting in a car wreck because we weren't paying attention or, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so here again, this is why it's so important to face ourselves and to heal ourselves, because in doing so, personally, we do so, we have that ripple effect out into the rest of the entire world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. You know, it is a pebble in a pond mentality, and understanding that eventually, good or bad, the small ripples you make will form a wave.
Yes, exactly.
Like they're still going to meet.
Yep. Yep.
The question is with what intensity? You know,
right.
If you're making a whole lot of negative ripples, eventually you're going to end up with a pretty nasty negative wave coming at you. And even going through that 3-4 day spout of depression, like what I said, she was like, oh, is there anything I can do to help? And I took a picture of the table of gear that I was working on. And I was like, gear gets me. Like, don't even worry about it. I know it sounds crazy, like burying myself in work, but for me, it's the fact of wiring things. Stuff like that. Like when I'm figuring out a wiring patch and how things are wired together, it's no different than getting to the root of my depression.
Yeah.
It's absolutely the same troubleshooting process for me.
Right.
So for me, rewiring a studio, things like that, like there's no better way for me to get over a 3 or 4 day depression because I'm validating myself in what I do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm validated at the end of it. I'm going to be able to look at it and go, man, look at that. That's just pretty and it's working, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's kind of that zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance of I'm going to tear my carburetor down again this week, not because I need to, but because I want to, and I want to explore that carburetor some more, you know?
Oh yeah, exactly. I'm very much the same way.
So what, with the last few minutes here, Anne, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've loved it because it really, I think, does dig into a different side of these communities that are out there, paranormal, cryptid, UFO, UAP, and how we relate as people, you know, and that's one of the things I've always said about going to these conferences that I sponsor and go to, is that I love the community beyond the speakers, beyond the presenters. It's the people and talking to them and hearing experiences and hearing why people believe what they believe. Prima facie, and just accepting somebody for who they are and what they believe. You know, it's a great exercise in humanity. What can people do to, I guess, begin to turn down this psychological path, this idea of how do we explore the psychology of these phenomena and the psychology of our reaction and interaction with them?
Well, it's a bit of a hard answer because the very first thing that we have to do is really look at ourselves. You want to study psychology. You want to look into understanding other people. You want to cultivate empathy, because we really do need to have empathy here.
Absolutely.
We have to understand that everybody's psychology is different, including our own. And what better way to start down that path than to look at yourself? I mean, I know for me, and this is no secret, I'm in therapy and I've done EMDR, and it has had a profound effect that when I can learn how I think, why I think the way that I do, where I even get tripped up in my thoughts and emotions, then I can understand and have empathy on why that may happen in other people. So I think that that really has to be the very first thing that we do, is familiarize ourselves with ourselves and our own psychology. Then we can go without, you know, outside of ourselves and really think about the community and think about, gosh, you know, trauma exists.
Yeah.
Period. And we really have to think about that, that people aren't just coming up to us to be crazy or to, you know, like there's really heartfelt reasons why these people are coming up to our tables, why they're telling us their stories, why they're wanting to buy our book. They're looking for answers. They're looking for connection. And that's the next thing that we really have to realize. And so I think from those two things right there, an evolution begins.
Yeah.
And then it really transforms. So once we start that, I think that will be the ripple effect within the community, but it really does start at home.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It starts with tending your own garden and getting the weeds out of it there, because if not, you're just bringing weeds with your flowers, you know?
Right.
And we have to be careful as not just a host, but as researchers, you know, as we're out there and we're sharing these things, because we, you know, it's funny. One of my favorite shows that I've worked in the last decade or so of my professional work, was a medical show with Alan Alda, who came and spoke, who now speaks, and uses the principles of comedy and writing to help teach scientists how to talk to people who aren't scientists.
I love it.
Because unfortunately they can be very cold and very matter of fact about their work. Not really passionate about it necessarily, even though they are.
Right.
And it's like, wow, you know, you just had an amazing opportunity with that multimillionaire that you were shaking hands with, and you had no idea how to express yourself to them. You know, like you could have just had tons of funding for your work, but you don't know how to speak like an actual human being.
Right.
You know, and how to humanize that, and how to bullet point it in 3 minutes.
Right.
And it's interesting to hear somebody speak on that and speak on like how to communicate in that kind of way, and to bring this full circle back to where we started with non-confrontational questions, things like that, you know, not talking in absolutes. When you talk in absolutes, you're going to exclude somebody, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And none of this is an absolute. That's like saying, like we say with King Gerhardt, that's like saying you're a Bigfoot expert.
Right.
You exactly. May be an expert in numerous fields in track identification, tracking animals, you know, animal behavior. But until we find a Bigfoot, there ain't no Bigfoot expert. You know,
right.
You're an expert in a lot of different fields. So we have to be willing to say these things. We have to be willing to have the deeper conversations about ourselves and how we got here and where we're going with it. You know,
exactly.
So thank you so much for your time, man. I greatly appreciate it. Let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, because you're out there writing now, all kinds of stuff. So, where can they go to keep up with all of your latest writing?
What? It's so brand new. I'm on Medium and I'm on Substack. And so on Medium, it's Entomology. And on Substack, I believe it's Lady Anne Celine 23.
Awesome.
I have it posted. I made a pinned post over on Facebook. So you can just type in Anne Celine on Facebook and I'll come up. And there's a pinned post that has like coffee cups on it, because I was announcing that I'm kind of going away from Facebook And I'm going to be more so on Medium and Substack as my main, because I love the community there, the interaction, the inspiration, and being able to write like I can. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anne, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the time. I can't wait to have you back on.
Thank you. It's been an
honor. Again and again to talk about this, because the world of psychology and paranormal are hand in hand for me. I do not see even a separation of veil between them. They are integrally intertwined. So thank you so much for your time.
Hang on
real quick while we say goodbye to the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Anne Saleen over at medium.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can go to CuriousRealm.com/videos and find all of the video channels of our guests, including our video channels there. All kinds of fun stuff. Make sure to stop on by CuriousResearch.org. That is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFOs, UAPs, and out doing field work, taking interviews, doing case files, things like that, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your way to keep in your pocket the data that you collect in the field and prepare it to shake hands with science. Thank you so much for your time tonight, everybody. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.